This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Just as everyone expected, it's New England and Indianapolis in the AFC Championship game, and I guess I meant Pittsburgh and Denver, but I understand that the NFL postseason will continue anyway, which gives us another excuse to talk to Paul Attner of the Sporting News. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, you just brought back all those bad memories I had last Sunday night in the press box. I see the Patriots going down Saturday night and the Colts going down Sunday, and I'm going, oh my goodness, what am I writing about now?
Well, we will talk about actual football in just a minute, but I have to address a very important issue first. Could this game coming up on Sunday break the record for most quarterback facial hair?
I mean, the Grizzly Adam versus the bad face job?
Yeah.
What is Ben Roethlisberger thinking? I mean, golly, you think he'd look in the mirror and say, this doesn't work. This does not work. I mean, Jake Plummer, I guess he's just going to carve out this unique persona, and if he gets the Super Bowl, you know, we'll all write about it and talk about it, and then he'll be famous.
I know that the common wisdom is that the Steelers, even though they're underdogs, are playing the best football perhaps of any of the four teams. But do they still get to say that after their running back fumbles on the 1 yard line and almost blows the game at the end?
Well, you are technical, aren't you?
Yeah, that's a real technical observation. He dropped the ball.
You got to point out all these flaws to the argument. No, you got to accept the common theory here, and don't point out all the negatives. The problem here is that the Steelers really, until that one little flaw in the ointment, were playing very well and have played very well and have won two straight in a row. And I think we're all going to try to overlook what Bettis did. And
Bettis certainly is.
Yeah, and I know. And I picked the Steelers, and you know how well I've done on my picks over the years on this program. So you know that now means the Broncos will win without question.
The NFC title game. Pitts, Seattle against Carolina. Much has been made of the Seahawks' home field advantage. Is that big a deal at this point in the season where both these teams have been through so much?
Doesn't look like it, does it? I mean, based on what we've seen so far in the playoffs, teams that are on the road seem to be able to play excellent football compared to 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago. And Seattle built a very good record based on a not a very challenging schedule, and I think that may expose them in this game because I don't think they've been as tested as Carolina, and Carolina is playing better than they are right now, and so I don't think home field's going to be worth a cup of coffee from Starbucks.
Seahawk running back and league most valuable player Sean Alexander suffered a concussion last week and played very little in that game. He's been cleared to play this week, but given that concussions take a while to recover from, how effective do you think he'll be?
How clear-headed will he be? Yeah, that's a good question. I don't like the idea of what you're saying here, and I agree with you 100%. A concussion is a concussion, and it doesn't go away in 3 days, 5 days, 7 days. It lingers, and yet because of the type of situation these guys are in, they feel compelled to want to play. Now, I'm not saying doctors clear them because the team puts pressure on them, but I think the doctors in these cases, if they see any possibility these guys are all right, they kind of give it the nod and say, yeah, go ahead and let's go ahead. But I would not want to be in Sean Alexander's situation right now because, I mean, we've seen Bill in other situations that, it doesn't take much for him to suffer yet one more concussion, not even a hard hit, and I don't think I'd want to be in that spot.
Carolina has its own injury problems. Running back Deshaun Foster is out with a broken ankle. Can wide receiver Steve Smith put the Panthers on his smallish shoulders again and lead them to another Super Bowl?
The world's biggest small shoulders, right?
Yeah, it could be, potentially.
Yeah, he's had a phenomenal postseason. I mean, a phenomenal year, but the postseason, what he did against Chicago last week was truly amazing, on top of an amazing performance against the Giants week before that, on top of an amazing performance against the Falcons week before that. It would seem at one point, if I listen to all the defensive gurus of this league, that you should be able to take away one player. You should be able to double team him, do something to get him out of the game, and not being able to beat you. But I haven't seen it so far. I mean, and until someone proves otherwise, I think he is good enough. Yeah, I really do to dominate this game, and he continues to be just a great story.
Paul, the Super Bowl is 2 weeks and 1 day away. Does that dismay you as much as it dismays me?
I'm trying not to think. You know, I don't want to get ahead of myself. I'm taking it one game at a time, Bill. I
mean, the cliche is already in 2 weeks to go.
I got a list here. You want some more? No,
no, stop. But I will ask you for a prediction.
Oh, for the Super Bowl?
Absolutely.
Wow, Bill, we haven't even got the teams yet. Well, I'm picking Carolina and in Pittsburgh. I guess that means I go with the AFC team, since I've written all year that the AFC is by far the strongest conference, and I can't wimp out now.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News. Paul, thanks again.
Hey, thanks, Bill.
On Monday, horses, breeders, owners, and jockeys will be honored at the 35th Annual Eclipse Awards. While the Sport of Kings pats itself on the back, one 16-year-old from LaGrange, Kentucky, will be making plans to crash future award ceremonies and winner's circles. Kathleen Adams of member station WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, reports.
20 minutes before the start of the third race at Turfway Park, thoroughbred trainer Vince White methodically places a saddle cloth on the back of Accordion Man, 4-year-old son of Storm Boot. Chestnut Colt hasn't won a race in 7 months. As White finishes saddling the horse in the paddock, he says Accordion Man's chances of winning are good with apprentice jockey Brandon Minock in the irons.
Ready to row?
Yep.
White gives Minock a leg up into the saddle, and the young jockey guides Accordion Man out onto the racetrack for the one-mile race.
Now on the outside, that Major Focus in third. Sonny White gets the endorsement by Nature's Candy. But now Accordion Man just rolls away with the lead.
One of the last horses to be loaded into the starting gate, Accordion Man breaks well and goes to the lead, a position the colt maintains throughout the race. Winning by 6 lengths, Accordion Man pays $22.80. Standing on the outer edges of the winner's circle are Minock's parents, Diane and Wayne.
Look at the smile. Look at the smile on his face. Look at him. He's so happy.
A former jockey turned thoroughbred trainer, Wayne Minock is also happy with the win. Brandon's third since becoming apprentice jockey in August.
I thought he rode a perfect race. Looked real fine. Used a lot of patience, held him back as long as he could.
Stepping off the jock scale, Minock, who at 5'3", weighs 106 pounds, catches his breath.
I thought he'd relax more, but then I just waited as long as I could to send him. He finally responded when I asked him to. He's the best of the bunch. Felt good.
At age 6, Minock began pestering his father to gallop thoroughbreds, but Wayne Minock insisted his son wait until he turned 9. By 11, he was breezing or working the 1,000-pound animals at the racetrack on weekends. Now that he's a jockey, Brandon is sometimes excused early from Oldham County High School so he can ride a Turfway. Again, Diane Minock.
They think it's pretty neat to have somebody in the school system that's already fulfilling a goal. There's so many kids that are 18, 19, 20 years old and still not doing anything with their lives. And here's Brandon, a junior in high school, and is already doing what he wants to do for a career.
Brandon is reserved with strangers. If you ask him what he enjoys about piloting thoroughbreds around an oval racetrack, the response you get is understated.
I like speed, and there's a bunch of speed in it, and it feels great when you have a nice horse underneath you. If you got a lot of horse left when you're turning for home, it feels great.
The teen opens up a bit more when recalling how the other jockeys celebrated his first win.
I had ice water and ketchup, mustard, hot sauce, baby powder put on me, put Vaseline in my hair. I didn't even care if they did it, I was so happy.
Today, the minimum age at which a jockey can be licensed in most states is 16. Mary Jean Wall covers horse racing for the Lexington Herald Leader. She says last month, Ohio raised its minimum age to 18 after 16-year-old apprentice jockey Josh Radosevich was killed at Beulah Park.
I don't think a 15 or 16-year-old is going to be able to make the flash mental decisions that a jockey has to make. And when you think, or when I think of a jockey, I think of people like Jerry Bailey and Pat Day, who are seasoned riders. We will always have apprentices coming along, and they have to be mentored by these seasoned riders, but there's a reason they're being mentored.
In 1978, at the age of 18, Steve Coffin became the youngest jockey to ever win racing's coveted Triple Crown aboard Affirmed. Like Minock, Coffin grew up part of a Kentucky racing family.
And I really started preparing to become a jockey when I was 12, so I had 4 years of preparation. You know, a lot of these kids that are 15 and 16, they just walked on the track 6 weeks ago, you know? And, you know, they do sometimes seem to, you know, try to get them rolling a little quicker than they're prepared for.
Coffin says racing needs to do more to nurture young riders both on and off the track. But he also thinks apprentices shouldn't be in such a hurry to achieve success.
If you have the desire, you know, to work your way to the top of the game, you know, I think that that's very doable for anybody who's willing to, you know, have some patience and work hard to be prepared for when those opportunities come, then you're able to capitalize on them.
Whether Brandon wins or loses, Diane Minock hits the speed dial on her cell phone and calls her father in Michigan after each race to let him know his grandson has returned safely, or, in her words, has both feet on the ground.
It's just makes your heart pound. You never know. You know, there's so much that could go wrong in that distance. You know, the 30 seconds or whatever it is there, and it's just scary. And to see him come along like that and ride a perfect race.
A typical work night for Minock includes getting on half a dozen horses. And as the teen waits in the jock's room for his next mount, he says Josh Radosevich's death hasn't dampened his enthusiasm for racing.
It's not the age that killed him, so it didn't really worry me. I mean, all jockeys do get hurt. Just know that's part of the job.
So far, that fearlessness has served Minock well. His record as of January 19th stood at 6 wins, 13 seconds, and 13 thirds from 106 starts. He's in the money 30% of the time and has earnings totaling over $76,000. For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Lexington, Kentucky.
It's 19. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, can a 4.5-year layoff help a basketball player's inside game? But first, yesterday, the U.S. Treasury Department announced that Cuba's baseball team is welcome to play in the World Baseball Classic. In line with a decades-long embargo, the Treasury Department had previously blocked the Cuban team, reasoning that its participation in the tournament might generate money for the Castro regime. Recently, Major League Baseball and the Players Association reapplied for Cuba's license after Cuba said that it would donate any profits it receives to victims of Hurricane Katrina. The Cuban national team won the Olympic gold medal in baseball in 1992, 96, and in 2004. The first World Baseball Classic will begin March 3rd, and the Cuban team will play in Group B against teams from Panama, Puerto Rico, and the Netherlands. Tennessee women's basketball coach Pat Summitt got win number 117 billion last night. Actually, that's an exaggeration, but not much of one. Joining me now to set the record straight is Michelle Smith, who writes about women's college basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me. Now, that was win 900. It only seems like a million billion.
I was going to say, Tennessee 80, Vanderbilt 68 on Thursday night, win number 900 for Pat Summitt. Her team is undefeated this season. How many wins do you suppose she'll have when she retires?
She's got a couple hundred more in her, I think. I mean, you know, I don't see Pat going anywhere for quite a while. Why would she? You know, she's recruiting the best players in the country. You know, right now they're the best team in the country. And I don't see why Pat would give up that gig.
Among the other undefeated teams is Duke, winner of two of their last three games by more than 30 points. What happens when Duke meets Tennessee on Monday?
Oh, I think it's going to be fun for everyone. This is a pretty big game. I mean, 1-2, we got a lot of that with the Tennessee-Connecticut matchup over the past few years. But, you know, I think this is going to be a lot of fun. Tennessee has played the toughest schedule in the country. They have ducked no one. They've played everybody. Duke has not played quite as difficult a schedule, won their games by a larger margin. So then you wonder a little bit, well, you know, how good are they? Are they, you know, if they're 30 points better than this team that they played, and Tennessee got by Vanderbilt. It's just, it's going to be a really interesting game. And then, you know, you've got Candace Parker, who's a fabulous player, the freshman, redshirt freshman at Tennessee, and Monique Curry is one of the best players in the country at Duke. It's going to be a tremendous amount of fun.
The team currently at number three, LSU, slipped by Alabama 79-43 on Thursday night. And on the same evening, Duke beat North Carolina State by 30, Purdue beat Penn State by 26, Georgia beat Mississippi State by 39.
Yeah.
These are not early season games, Michelle. Will the hideous mismatch always be a fact of women's college basketball?
You know, I think that there's just, you know, I think in some cases there's a talent disparity. People say, though, that the parity is spread across the country. I mean, you know, I think there are more good teams, but it's still, for the women's game, has its limits. I think there are still big disparities. I mean, North Carolina State was ranked at one point this season. They were, you know, hovering around the bottom half of the top 25 poll. So, you know, to have Duke be 30 points better than that team, I mean, it's surprising. And yet, but you know, LSU played Connecticut earlier in the week, and they lost.
Mm-hmm.
So, it, you know, it's, I think there's, among the top teams, maybe the top 35 or 40 teams, there's more parity than there's been.
This week, Kayla Burt, the senior guard from the University of Washington, ended her basketball career. She had been playing with a defibrillator implanted in her chest since suffering cardiac arrest 3 years ago. There have been lots and lots of determined basketball players, but Ms. Burt may have just retired the trophy in that category.
Kayla is a great kid, and the fact that she got to come back at all, I think she views as a blessing that they made it work so that she could come back. They apparently reached an agreement that if she had any problems with her heart, that that was going to be it, that they wouldn't mess around with it. And when they figured out that the defibrillator hadn't malfunctioned or hadn't fired inappropriately, but had indeed shocked her out of an irregular rhythm, she knew that that was it. And I think she seemed always to be pretty at peace with that.
According to the latest graduation success rate statistics, which were released just a couple of days ago, female basketball players are graduating at a rate of 81%, while men are at 64%. Are you surprised that as the women's game has become more popular and seen more good teams develop and more recruiting and all the rest of it, the graduation rate among female players has remained this high?
Not really, because what are you playing for after college? There are precious few spots in the WNBA, which is, you know, it's lovely that it's there for those top caliber players who want to go someplace and play after college. But there are so few spots. I mean, really, the women are not playing for, not necessarily any more than some of the men are playing for. Percentage-wise, it may work out to be the same. But I think that women have always gone into their college athletic experience knowing that there wasn't necessarily going to be something on the other side, and that getting that degree and finishing that experience was going to be paramount to them moving on to the next phase of their lives.
Michelle, a quick glance at the rankings reveals Maryland, DePaul, and Ohio State among the top 10, not among the usual suspects there. More evidence that the field is getting deeper all the time?
Yeah, I think so, and they're all very good teams. And when you get to the championship games and that, it still may not materialize, although last year was great. Last year was Baylor, Michigan State, two newcomers, and, you know, everybody was thrilled with that. So maybe it's heading in that direction, although, you know, the way things are going this year, you've got Duke, you've got Tennessee, you've got Connecticut coming on really strong. You've got just teams that, you know, a lot of familiar names back up at the top of the rankings.
Michelle Smith writes about women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
If you're a successful college basketball player entering your junior year, leading a Division I program to new heights while thoroughly enjoying the academic experience to which your scholarship entitles you, how can life get better? Simple. The program for which you're starring, in this case the women's basketball team at Boston College, can recruit the one player you most hoped that it would recruit. That's how beautifully things seemed to be working out in the fall of 2000 for Becky Gottstein when BC signed up her younger sister, Carolyn.
Carolyn is my best friend in the world. And, you know, we talked about the opportunity to play again together. You know, we brought a state championship to Albany High, and that was huge, and we played so well together.
The expectation at BC was that Becky and Carolyn, both over 6 feet, both exceptional high school players in Albany, New York, would continue to play well together at BC. Gottstein the elder scored nearly 1,500 points in her college career. eventually led BC to the Big East Conference Championship game in 2002 and to multiple NCAA tournament appearances. But is Becky, now an administrator and assistant varsity basketball coach at St. John's Prep in Danvers, Massachusetts, puts it today, sometimes dreams don't follow the script. Partway through her freshman year, Carolyn quit the basketball team.
When Carolyn was 18 years old or 17 years old when she was a freshman entering, it was too much on her plate. And, you know, one thing that I've taken from Boston College is it's made me mentally tougher. And some people can't handle all of that stress, the academics. It was extremely important to Carolyn to do well academically.
When it became apparent Carolyn Gottstein would be one of those people who couldn't happily balance the obligations of a Division I basketball player with the rest of her life, Sister Becky was devastated.
Sometimes when you want something so bad for somebody else, you really, you know, you can be a little bit forceful with it. And I wanted her to be happy so bad, and I wanted her to do well so bad as an older sister and as a protector, that when I saw her struggle, it just was very difficult for both of us. I wanted her to do well and to be happy more than anything. And when she wasn't happy and when she wasn't getting any happier, it was very difficult for both of us.
As difficulties go, this one was relatively benign. Carolyn Gottstein liked Boston College. She just didn't like playing basketball there enough to make the commitment the program required. Having surrendered her basketball scholarship, she took out a lot of loans, devoted more time to her studies, became involved in various tutoring programs, and found herself an internship with the Cape Cod Baseball League. In other words, she had a full and rewarding college experience. It just didn't include any more varsity basketball. Until this fall. Because as it turned out, by 2005, 4.5 years after she decided to stop playing at BC, Carolyn Gottstein found herself an opportunity to play somewhere else.
I received a letter in like August. Dear Coach, I don't know if you remember me, but I played high school basketball in Albany. My name is Carolyn Gottstein. I was a blah, 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 blah. And at first I thought someone was pranking me.
That's Barbara Stevens, the coach of the women's basketball team at Bentley College in Waltham, Massachusetts. I spoke to her during a practice last week. The winner of over 700 games and architect of a program that has made the Division II Sweet 16 15 times over the past 18 years, Stevens was thrilled when she learned that Carolyn Gottstein's letter was no hoax. She assumes the rest of the coaches in the New England 10 Conference were less enthusiastic.
Well, you know, everybody in the conference, I think, probably looked at the fact that Carolyn was coming here and just shook their head and said, oh, no. Because back when Carolyn was in high school, everyone knew of her and knew what a tremendous player she was.
Barbara Stevens was eager to see if Carolyn Gottstein could still be a tremendous player. The Division II rules stipulate that a player must complete her 4 years of basketball within 10 semesters. Carolyn, who spent a year working for Fidelity Investments in Boston after graduating from Boston College, had 2 semesters of eligibility remaining when she called Coach Stevens. They arranged a 1-year scholarship so Gottstein could pursue a master's degree in business at Bentley, simultaneously finishing up her college basketball career. It was an opportunity to which Gottstein knew she'd have to bring the sort of dedication she hadn't been able to muster at BC.
When I talked to Coach Stevens, you know, we knew it was only going to be a 1-year thing. So when it is such a short period of time, you have nothing but to give 100%, but to make the most of it.
Through Bentley's first 14 games this season, Carolyn Gottstein was averaging 13 points and 8 rebounds per game. When the second semester began, Bentley, which had started slowly, was several games over 500. Not only that, Gottstein is the undisputed leader in off-court assists to teammates headed for business careers.
They do find it interesting because I worked at Fidelity Investments and I was able to get my Series 6 and 63 licenses. So a couple times, you know, if they have finance homework or investments homework, you know, they think I have an inside track. But, you know, a lot of times that, you know, they're helping me with some stuff that I need to shake the rust off of.
Regarding basketball, Carolyn Gottstein shook off the rust pretty quickly, and the reward has been gratifying. A couple of weeks ago, she starred in Coach Stevens' 700th win, an occasion that may have pleased older sister Becky, who was in the stands at Bentley for that game, almost as much as it pleased Carolyn.
It was funny, for that 700th win that I got a chance to go, I left her a message after just saying that I got goosebumps just thinking about it. She was so happy playing, cheering on the bench with her teammates and just playing. And I was, as a big sister, I was just so happy that she found that playing basketball.
For the sake of perspective, it's worth mentioning that the pride Becky Gottstein feels for her younger sister has not prevented her from kidding the first-year Bentley player for being an old rookie.
At one point in the beginning of the season, when the preseason was going on, Carolyn, we were supposed to have dinner one night, and Carolyn called and said that she couldn't because they had a recruit on campus. And I go, Carolyn, what are you going to talk to this kid about? You're 17, or she's 17, you're 23. What are you going to tell her? You were Miss New York State basketball when she was 8?
Yeah, Carolyn might have replied. Better late than not at all, big sister. And big sister, having been there, would have agreed. And so would little sister, because there's another basketball playing Gottstein out there. Her name is Emily. She plays for St. Rose College back home in Albany. And Carolyn is looking forward to the matchup she couldn't have imagined before this season.
January 28th in Albany, New York. So one time we get, well, for the regular season, one time against St. Rose. And, you know, they're having an up and down season, too. So it's going to be a battle. You know, obviously, Becky, my older sister Becky, will be coming home for the weekend. She said she'll be cheering for both of us.
She's rooting for a tie.
I don't think a tie, maybe just a good, clean, safe game, and may the best team win.
If that doesn't sound appropriately competitive, maybe that's because it's a perspective a player is unlikely to have earned unless she's recently reclaimed a passion she thought she'd lost 5 years ago.
No longer jealous of so she ran around the house with her curlers up. No longer jealous of her sister.
You're listening to Only a Game. Gabe O'Connor's story about a competitive eating tournament in last week's program provoked considerable consternation. Kimberly Masati, who hears Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio, wrote to say she was appalled. What next, she asked. Who can drive the length of Vermont on bald tires without going off the interstate? Please stay away from the sideshow circus stories. Judy Cook, who hears the show on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, was similarly discouraged by that story, and she emailed as follows. Perhaps the people who engage or engorge in this non-sport could better spend their time and resources stocking shelves in a food pantry. How many meals could be served with the hot dogs and chicken wings that are devoured in a single competition? This week's email also contained a note from Jason Kahn, who listens to the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, in which he said, "Thanks for giving me a reason to get up before 7 on Saturday and not depressing me, and for bringing listeners esoteric stories about interesting people involved in bizarre activities." In my conversation with Charlie Pierce January 7th, I flippantly suggested that the single wing, a football formation quasi-popular a whole lot of decades ago, had gone the way of the leather helmet and the flying wedge. Tom Kelly, who hears Only a Game on KNOW in Minneapolis, emailed to say the single wing is alive and well in Sigourney, Iowa, where Coach Bob Howard and his Sigourney Kyoto team have been using it since 1987. Mr. Kelly says old-timers were delighted with the return of the single wing, which apparently recently enabled Sigourney Kyoto to win its third state championship. Kat Serby, a WBUR listener, emailed to say, "I loved your bit on yoga." She was referring to Jillian Ferris Cole's profile of the pro wrestler who had started teaching yoga. Despite the weird, unhealthy twist of Diamond Dallas Page's sexualization dumb-guying it down, she wrote, "it was still a refreshing piece, dispelling some myths about yoga." You can let us know how you feel about the program by writing us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can also reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. And you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. We'll be right back. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
The listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a fictional depiction of the NBA that may be closer to the truth than Commissioner Stern, among others, would like. But first, for a discussion of the week's news, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce, who's at WUWM in Milwaukee this week. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
What's up in Milwaukee? Marquette getting ready to make a pre-March move?
They're playing the fighting non-Hiberians of Our Lady of the Plains in South Bend and tonight, and I have to go up and wreck some young minds at the journalism school this
Excellent.
Afternoon.
Excellent. Commissioner Stern handed New York Knicks forward Antonio Davis a five-game suspension for entering the stands during a game Wednesday night in Chicago. Is this a fitting punishment?
I thought it was a little bit harsh. I would have gone with one game. I know they're sensitive because of what happened between the Pistons and the Pacers last year. This was a guy trying to extricate his wife from what looked like trouble. The level of participation involved can be judged by the fact that the civilian in question has already filed an eight-figure lawsuit. I think one game would have been all right. I think a fine would have been all right.
Is it fair to say that Mr. Stern would have faced criticism regardless of whether he had suspended Davis for zero games or banished him for life from the league?
Yeah, probably. But that, I mean, that gives you all the running room in the world to do the right thing. If you're going to get hit no matter what you do, you might as well do it right.
As you said, the fan who was allegedly bothering Antonio Davis's wife is threatening to sue, but he has said an apology would pretty much resolve the matter. You think that's likely?
No, first of all, I don't think he's telling the truth in saying that the apology is going to resolve the matter. But second of all, I don't know that there shouldn't be apologies all the way around here. I'll tell you who should apologize to the people of America is the Yutz, who was two rows in front waving at the camera while all this was going on.
Pat Summitt has climbed the mountain to her 900th win by virtue of Tennessee's 80-68 victory over Vanderbilt on Thursday night. Any reason to believe she won't summit Mount 1500 anytime soon?
No, I'm not sure about 1500, but certainly 1000 is well within sight. And you have to remember one thing about women's basketball. It's one of the few sports that's gotten more competitive over the arc of this coach's career.
Mm-hmm.
When she started out, there weren't but a couple of women's teams in the country that could give her team a run, let alone beat them. Now there are several dozen in the tournaments, and you're talking about a longer NCAA tournament within which to win games. She has more opportunities, but it's against tougher competition.
The Australian Open began on Monday, and we've already seen early ousters of Leighton Hewitt, Andy Roddick, Serena Williams, her sister, of course, an even earlier ouster. Do you still plan to watch the proceedings down under?
I always measure tennis tournaments based on the number of players still competing that I've heard of. And the Australian Open is falling off the radar screen very fast. The French Open generally falls off the radar screen when they do the draw.
Well, it's conference championship weekend in the National Football League. Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger gave the press a sentence this week that began, quote, "A month or so ago, the only people who believed we could be in this situation, ... Are these guys contractually obligated to say this kind of stuff?
It's a microchip that gets inserted on draft day every year at the NFL draft or perhaps during the combine. Roethlisberger has a point, but the problem is, of course, nobody thought he could get there because the Pittsburghs were playing terribly. Now they're playing very well, and yes, they can get to the Super Bowl. I'm willing to say it, Ben. You can get to the Super Bowl. Now go out and play the game.
The referee who disallowed a Pittsburgh interception against the Colts in last weekend's divisional game had a rock thrown through the window of his house on Monday, and the guy lives in California. Who knew California's had a team in that game?
Well, not just that, but the guy from Pittsburgh must have had a hell of an arm, huh? I got a million of them, and some of them really stink. I have a feeling gambling was involved in the latest act of vandalism.
I'm shocked.
It was either a frustrated Steeler fan or a frustrated grammarian, because the explanation that guy gave was an outburst, to paraphrase Mel Brooks, of authentic football gibberish.
Joey Porter of the Steelers was moved by the ref's bad call to suggest a league-wide conspiracy against the Steelers. He won't be fined for those comments. Why not?
I'm sort of nonplussed by the fact that he's not going to be fined. He did allege a conspiracy reaching all the way to the top, after all. Of course, I mean, there may be an entire category of people that the NFL just doesn't fine because, they're kind of nuts.
The 60-man rosters for the World Baseball Classic were announced this week. Have you had a chance
to... And Alex Rodriguez is on four of them.
He's on at least four of them, and there's still plenty of time for him to leap about onto some others. You have a pick in this tournament?
I'm anxious to see the team from the Dominican Republic, obviously. And I'm anxious to see what uniform Alex decides to put on the day of the first game. I think he should just go through the thing like Pele used to when he was with the Cosmos and play for every team.
Jerry Bailey, twice the rider of a Kentucky Derby winner, announced his retirement this week. Charlie, he'll become an analyst for ESPN and ABC Sports. Bailey said of the change, quote, "The new seat will be far less dangerous than my old one, and it also includes lunch." That's one of those funny and yet not so funny lines, isn't it?
It's not a very good life, actually. I mean, even Jerry Bailey, who's arguably the best rider of his era, did not live a very luxurious life as he tried to keep his career going.
We have a new entry, Charlie, in the goofy sports category, skating with celebrities. Were you able to take that in?
The great thing about this was Todd Bridges, he of the brief career but longer rap sheet, was part of it, which is the only thing Todd Bridges has skated on since his adolescence.
And finally, Charlie, Nathan Mallett, the 24-year-old man who ran onto the field during the Steelers-Browns game back on Christmas Eve, was sentenced this week to a weekend in jail, and the judge stipulated Super Bowl weekend, and he also said Mr. Mallett will not be allowed to see the game on TV or listen to it on the radio. So, cruel and unusual punishment?
This is terrific piece of creative sentencing by whoever this judge is. I guess Mr. Mallett's going to have to hope there's a really good Masterpiece Theater running in whatever cell he's in.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he's working on a book about New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. Foul Lines, subtitled A Pro Basketball Novel, begins with the introduction of a rookie named Kwanzi Parker, who, quote, like most professional athletes, tooled around in an automobile equipped with jet engines, two elaborate hood ornaments, neon underbelly, and vanity plates, but he just hated it when somebody recognized him. Kind of makes you wonder whether co-authors Jack McCallum and L. John Wertheim, Sports Illustrated writers, both had anybody in mind, doesn't it? Jack McCallum joins me from his home in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Jack, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
And John Wertheim joins me from New York. Welcome to the program, John.
Hi, Bill. Thanks.
Kwanzi Parker may not be as easy to recognize, actually, as the fictional commissioner of your fictional pro basketball league. He's Daniel Drang, quote, a calculating autocrat who took to power the way moths take to light. A necessarily stern portrayal of a commissioner.
Really?
Sounds like, well, Bud Selig, doesn't it?
Yeah. Bud Selig is actually who we had in mind. We figured that if anyone in here, and actually, Bill, most of the characters are composites. I mean, we can maybe talk a little bit about who we had in mind, but obviously if you have the commissioner of a league, since Stern has been running the league for the last 25 years, kind of hard to disguise him, but... We figure with David's salary and what he's been through and everything else, he's big enough to take whatever's thrown at him.
To be fair, the novel also includes a young team owner who, quote, carefully cultivates the image of a maverick. I wonder who served for the basis of that character.
That's Senator Herb Cole you're talking about right there, owner of the Milwaukee Bucks. No, I think part of this is that the NBA has reached this sort of level of absurdity. We thought it was just so ripe for a send-up that with all these characters, be they Maverick owners or players with absurd vanity plates or David Stern, we So this was all sort of the inspiration for this book to begin with.
Well, send up, John, is an interesting way to put it. I wondered if getting even with self-important athletes, autocratic commissioners, allegedly maverick owners, and those who have so thoroughly commercialized sports was part of the motivation for writing this novel.
Well, we said in the, you know, I've covered it for 20 years. I'm a little bit older than John by a generation. That's, we figured we had each generation covered. But you get to the end of an NBA season, and you kind of laugh about all the incredible stuff that's happened and what you've been through. But honestly, and we said this in the acknowledgement that we really do love this game, in many ways, it is the greatest sport still to cover. You know, the NBA has no franchise on self-important players or the corporatization of America. This is just what we happen to know. It's my major sport. And with John, who also covers tennis, it's a sport that he's been around a lot also. So naturally, this was our target, the familiar target. But honestly, we really do love the game, really like most of the people in it, and hope that everyone takes it as a satire or, as John said, a send-up.
Again, along the line of fiction that isn't really fiction, you've got this observation that the only player in your league without a tattoo consisting of Mandarin characters is Ming Li, and one player's tattoo, which is supposed to mean honor, pride, warrior, in fact reads tongs, yak, ashtray. Any particular player modeling for that one?
There was a story involving Marcus Camby back when he was playing for the Knicks, who mm-hmm. had a tattoo, and very similar to that. He thought it meant something that an East Asian studies major later revealed it to be. But, you know, a lot of you sort of, you cover the league, as both Jack and I have, and you've got a notebook full of anecdotes and color. And when you write stories for Sports Illustrated, a lot of that, you know, just for space purposes, if nothing else, gets sort of, you know, relegated to the cutting room floor. And this was a way to sort of take all of these sort of anecdotes and colorful characters and actually make some use out of them.
I had a player recently. He had his area, you know, he's kind of proud of where he came from, and he had his area code tattooed on his arm. And I said to him, well, you know, the area code has changed since then. You know how area codes change? And he just showed me the other arm, whereupon he had put the new area code on. So he's covered with both area codes. Presumably the zip code hasn't changed. That would be the next tattoo.
Excellent.
He would get. But tattoos are so much a part of the that they've almost become a, sort of unlampoonable, because every single person has one. So we just kind of came upon this thing. Actually, that was John's story, and as long as I've been around, I had not heard the story. And when one of us would come up with a story, we would that the other one didn't know.
That would go in the book.
No, it was in the book. Yeah, I mean, it was in the book. There was no question about that.
Well, a lot of books come about through collaboration, but that's not so often the case with fiction. John, how did you guys go about writing a novel together?
Well, that was always sort of the tricky part, but it also made it a lot more fun. We sort of had a rough idea of where this was going plot-wise. And we would, you know, we would sort of do our chapters and alternate and meet for lunch and read what the other had written and critique it. And, you know, sometimes it didn't work. We would have to go back and sort of fiddle with the order. And other times it sort of worked surprisingly, sort of seamlessly. But that to us, to me at least, that was really half the fun, is doing this in such an unconventional way.
Jack, is seamless the word that springs to mind when the writing process is discussed?
Well, it sounds, you know, like self-adulation, but it is. You know, early in the process, John had sent me an email that he came upon a quote from Evelyn Waugh, who said, two people writing a book is like three people having a baby. And I don't even know exactly what that means outside of it's difficult. And of the whole process, that seemed to be the least problem. And the one worry we had was with two people writing a book, when we did assign distinct chapters to each other, would it sound like one voice? But anyone that has read it so far, I think that's probably, you know, if we have an accomplishment about it, I think that's probably what it would be, that two people did come out sounding like one, and it was just due to the collaborative process. I mean, we broke down every paragraph. You read the first paragraph of the book. I began writing that paragraph, but half of the paragraph is John's. And I remember he added neon underbelly and, you know, something else. So I just go back to every paragraph once in a while, and I said, well, I wrote that, but John rewrote that, and then I rewrote that. That's kind of how the whole book worked.
John, have you heard from any players or players' wives or families or coaches or league officials who've read the book yet? Do you have any idea how it's coming across in the basketball community?
Well, it's still early in the game, but I think we're really going to stress the point. This wasn't necessarily meant to shame anyone or to, you know, the answer is no. We haven't heard from anyone yet. So it's
the defense. You're playing defense
this, right?
Now.
Yeah,
players
exactly.
Players are notoriously. I remember I did a book on the Celtics a number of years ago, and in which I talked a lot about Larry Bird, and some people thought. I mean, I love Larry Bird. He's one of my favorite guys. But you know, I guess in doing an honest portrayal, some of his crustiness came out. You know, Larry can be a crusty guy and stuff on his teammates. And I just remember that. Larry, whether or not he read it, and I don't know, just absolutely couldn't have cared less. But his wife, had she had an M16, you know, would have aimed it, like, right at me. I think players probably aren't really, they get sensitive once in a while to stuff in the paper they read every day, in their local paper. You know, but by and large, I don't think that's probably who we'll hear from. I think it will be more the league officials and things like that. I guess that's what we're kind of waiting for.
Well, I just hope that you can count on Commissioner Stern having a sense of humor.
I'm sure we can. If there's one thing he's known for, it's levity.
Jack McCallum is one of the authors of Foul Lines, a pro basketball novel published by Simon & Schuster. He joined me from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Jack, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
And his collaborator is John Wertheim, who spoke to us from New York. John, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill. Pleasure.
Come on. What I live for? Basketball, beats and bras. From Italy to the U.S., yes, it's raw. I'm in search for the one that make my wealth feel poor. Who can ignore this spotlight life of grandma? Am I done for? Have I found the ore? Should I search still? There's plenty of women with sex appeal when it's filled.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Splash Studios in New York and from Amanda Shaloub at WUWM in Milwaukee. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Foul Lines, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from former Boston College basketball star Becky Gottstein, who comments on her condition following a recent staff versus varsity game at St. John's Prep.
That day after was a little sore. It's starting to sound like my dad when he wakes up in the morning.
Yeah, welcome to the working world, rookie. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Cash if it's half stocks and bonds. Laugh when it crash. Are you the type to brag when jewels you flash? Type with your X-Men that pushes jack. Type that love no scrubs. Her pigeons ain't got mad. Type that can't stand a woman with a own cash, you know, like Lauren, but claim she ain't rap. Type to get out in public, reframe my hand.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. From NPR member stations. From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.